Each year, the graduating class invites a distinguished guest to share some remarks with us on class day. And today, it is my privilege to introduce Samantha Power as our 2010 class day speaker. Ms. Power knows something about graduating from Harvard Law School because she did so herself in 1999. But she arrived here already a seasoned war correspondent, having covered the wars in the former Yugoslavia for publications like U.S. News and World Report, the Boston Globe, and the New Republic. While in law school, Ms. Power wrote a paper on American responses to 20th century genocide. This paper received a P, but unlike is the case for most of us, this P stood for Pulitzer. The book that paper eventually turned into, A Problem from Hell, America in the Age of Genocide, won the 2003 Pulitzer Prize, the National Book Critics Circle Award, and a Council on Foreign Relations Prize. In addition, that book, along with Ms. Power's further reporting in publications like The New Yorker, is widely credited with really helping getting the world's attention on the genocide in Darfur. Additionally, Ms. Power has continued to report from all over the world, from places like East Timor, Rwanda, Zimbabwe. Back here in Cambridge, she founded the Carr Center for Human Rights Policy at the Kennedy School of Government, where she serves as the Anna Lind Professor of Practice of Global Leadership and Public Policy. Her second book, Chasing the Flame, Sergio Vieira de Mello and the Fight to Save the World, was published last year and is the basis for the documentary Sergio, which premiered on HBO earlier this month. In 2005, Ms. Power left Harvard to work as a fellow in the offices of the newly elected senator from Illinois, Barack Obama, class of 91, and she served as a senior advisor to his presidential campaign. Today, Ms. Power continues to advise the president and serve her country as a special assistant to the president and senior director for multilateral affairs and human rights at the National Security Council. So we are thrilled today to have Ms. Power, whose career has had such remarkable achievement in areas like journalism, academia, and government. And her life and work really shows us the power of ideas and persuasion to spur action, the reward for taking risks in our careers, and just how much you can do with an HLS degree and a commitment to justice. It is my honor to welcome to the podium a genuine American public intellectual, Ms. Samantha Power.
Hi there. Graduating students, parents, it's been a while. Can we get a big shout out for the parents and the step parents here today? Stepfathers, stepmothers, mothers, fathers. It goes without saying that none of us would be here without you, literally. And I am personally more than a little humbled to be up here during your commencement festivities, to be surrounded by this ferociously talented faculty and these unbelievable students that you've been hearing about. No longer students, actually, graduates. One sign of how seriously I take this assignment is that I've actually invited my parents to your commencement, which is maybe a little pathetic. Thank you so much for having me, again, graduates and Dean Minow. Dean Minow, that has such a nice ring to it. Elena Kagan is a very, very tough act to follow, but Harvard Law School could not have made a better choice in choosing Professor Minow. She has many, many virtues, but the one that I cherish most is the way that she unfailingly treats students as peers. Each of you who have taken her classes or engaged her on law, politics, geopolitics, or your personal lives know what I'm talking about. And I can say from experience that when you look into Dean Minow's eyes, the reflection you see of yourself is the person you hope you can become. Benjamin Franklin once said, "Tell me and I forget, teach me and I remember, involve me and I learn." The Minow stamp on this law school will be an involved student body, involved in learning, involved in tailoring what is taught, and involved in shaping the world beyond the ivory tower. Congratulations, Dean Minow, on a stellar first year as Dean of Harvard Law School. In the old days, before I went into government, I gave a few commencement addresses, and I enjoyed them a lot. Now I'm in the Obama administration, and there's a risk that something I say here today will be associated with a certain other Harvard Law School graduate, who's my boss. I talked to a senior White House official about this speech and told him that I was half dreading doing it because in my current job, I couldn't actually say anything. And he said, sure you can. And I said, well, no, I know I can, but I just can't say anything interesting. And he said, no, Samantha, you just can't say anything controversial. And I said, well, unfortunately with me, those are kind of concentric, overlapping circles, but maybe it's like a Venn diagram where there might be this tiny sliver of space where, and I gotta find it here today, that is both non-controversial and interesting, and that's the sliver of space I'm gonna seek to find here, and you'll know in about 15 minutes whether I have succeeded. My husband, Cass Sunstein, is here with me today. Many of you have made use of his constitutional law or administrative law casebook. Luckily, when I took con law here with Larry Tribe, I didn't use Professor Sunstein's casebook. If I had, I actually don't think it would have been appropriate for me to date him. Dating somebody whose casebook you have used would have crossed into what my girlfriends and I call heebie-jeebie territory. But I will tell you this, I would trade every last Ivy League degree for just a single day with Cass as a companion. This audience is filled with overachievers. This is not a revelation. You can spot an overachiever early. Overachievers wear such heavy backpacks in elementary school that no hurricane could topple them as they wait at the bus stop. Overachievers take so many Kaplan LSAT practice tests that Kaplan actually runs out of sample questions. Overachievers have great trouble starting a book but not finishing it. After all, the point is less the content of the book than the act of turning the final page. Overachievers study right up until the last minute, genuinely believing that the extra 5 minutes of reviewing a civil procedure outline will make all the difference. Most overachievers care more about their grades than their sex lives. Though there may be a few here who strive for overachieving in all domains. Overachievers were once those who tutored in low-income school districts, but now in the 21st century, they are those who sneak across the border into Burma and actually build schools from scratch. Overachievers unfortunately often risk their lives by doing work on their BlackBerries while driving. Graduates, if you hear nothing else today, please don't text and drive. If Cass and I are any indicator, overachievers watch the Olympics in middle age and fantasize about taking up curling because it looks like the one sport we can still win an Olympic medal in. There's way too much recognition in that laughter in this audience. Overachievers don't like failing, and they do like winning. Overachievers often have a hole in their psyche, and achievement is their way of filling that hole. As my favorite singer Leonard Cohen likes to say, there is a crack in everything. That's how the light gets in. I gather from my mother, who is here today, as I mentioned, that the first sign I was determined to become an overachiever came early. She had grown up in County Cork, Ireland, and had moved temporarily to England. In 1975, she was simultaneously playing world-class squash, attending medical school, and trying to complete her PhD in biochemistry. Scary. And all this while, she was taking care of a tiny, redheaded, demanding daughter. I always thought my mother was extraordinary, but now that I have a tiny, redheaded, demanding one-year-old son, I literally marvel at how she did all she did. Well, this PhD of hers took years to complete, and finally, one day, she brought it to the printers to get it bound. In those days, there were no Kinkos on every corner, so when you turned something into the printers, you were making a permanent commitment. When she picked it up, she was elated. This was a very, very big deal. Her 300-page-plus treatise had acquired this splendid blue binder. The dissertation was a monument to close to a half decade of work and passion. She laid it out on the kitchen table so she could turn it in the next day to her academic supervisor, and she went to bed content. But when my mother woke up on her big day, her overachiever 5-year-old had struck. Emblazoned on the front of what had been the immaculate blue cover of her bound dissertation were words scrawled in bright orange crayon, Samantha Power did this. Again, way too much recognition. When I wrote my book, A Problem from Hell, my mother actually described it as my second book. Now that I'm in my late 30s rather than my pre-kindergarten years, my sense of what counts as real achievement, I confess, has evolved. I'm still an overachiever of a certain sort, but now I look at the ring on Cass's finger or my infant son splashing around in the bath, and I say, wow, how did Samantha Power do that? My memories of this place are fond. It was the last pure oasis of thought unmediated by politics that I have inhabited. I came to Cambridge, as was mentioned, straight from a war zone. I'd been a journalist in Bosnia in the early 1990s. So the conventional stresses of HLS seemed mild in comparison. But I felt a different kind of vulnerability, as if the qualities that had served me in other environments did me no good here. As 1Ls, we were taught that right and wrong was less important than the quality of one's argument. And since I didn't know how to make good legal arguments, I was not at the top of my game. How many of you got through law school without experiencing your awful paper chase moment? Well, I very nearly escaped. It was not until the first day of my final semester here at Harvard Law School, the spring of my third year, long past the time I should have learned to think like a lawyer, when I heard those feared words out of my professor's mouth, "Miss Power, will you kindly state the case?" I nearly died. I'd survived the siege of Sarajevo, but my heart raced, my tummy somersaulted, and a voice inside my head tried to soothe me. "This can't be worse than Slobodan Milosevic. This can't be worse than Slobodan Milosevic." But it was. The case was Spalding versus Zimmerman, and mercifully, I had read it. Back in the 1950s, there had been a car accident. A guy called John Zimmerman had rear-ended a 20-year-old named David Spalding. Spalding's ribs were broken, and he suffered some internal bleeding in the head. He sued Zimmerman for damages. Fairly straightforward. But controversy arose when Zimmerman, the bad driver, contracted a doctor to examine Spalding in order to gauge the gravity of his injuries. The doctor detected an aortal aneurysm that might rupture and cause Spalding, the person who'd been rear-ended, cause his death. Spalding was oblivious to his condition. Only Zimmerman and his lawyer possessed the vital, life-saving information. My ethics professor asked me whether Zimmerman's lawyer had a duty to disclose what he knew of Spalding's medical condition, when non-disclosure could result in severe harm. I was confused by this question. I looked around at my classmates, assuming that they too would be surprised by the professor's line of inquiry, but they seemed unflustered. I said simply, we're talking about an aneurysm. Yes, I'm aware of that, Ms. Power, but what should the defendant's lawyer do? The professor asked. I said, pardon me? It's an aneurysm. Yes, we've all read the case, the professor continued, but what should the defendant's lawyer do? I was totally confused. If Zimmerman's lawyer doesn't tell Spalding, Spalding might die, I said. By this time, virtually every hand in the class had shot up into the sky. Everyone understood the grave fallacy of my thinking. If Zimmerman's lawyer disclosed Spalding's medical condition, think of the spillover effects. What defendant would ever trust his lawyer again? How would our system of justice fare if a defense lawyer privileged the needs of the plaintiff over those of the defendant, who after all was not necessarily responsible for the aneurysm? What I had long suspected to be true was now official in my third year. I was structurally incapable of fully thinking like a lawyer. But while that aspect of thinking like a lawyer didn't stick, I did learn two very, very big things here. And I think it's true of the graduates as well. I wouldn't be surprised. I think every HLS grad gained here an ability to argue better. Now, all the parents in the audience are going to protest. They will tell tales of your pre-verbal, pig-headed toddler selves that indicate that you were serving up good arguments before you were weaned off diapers. Many of you have probably always been the advocate in your family. But parents, siblings, you think it was bad before they came to Harvard Law School when you were growing up with these people? Just wait. Have you argued with them lately? Not a lot of fun. The graduates of 2010 have built on already formidable foundations and gained literally daunting powers of argumentation. Where once their emotions might have stood in the way, this place has taught them to channel those emotions so that they can parse and rebut arguments with a clinical coldness that can be devastatingly effective. HLS grads, as you head out into the world, you actually have to be careful with this scalpel that this place has helped you sharpen. Like any scalpel, its incisions can cause severe bleeding. But like any medical scalpel, it can also help heal those in need right many wrongs, and end a whole lot of pain out there. Reason is the tool that this place has given you, but justice is the cause that must lie within you. A regard for the welfare of others simply can't be taught. I have not practiced law, but I have used what I learned here in every article I've ever written, every cause I've advocated for. I use my law school education every day in government, anticipating the other side's argument, mobilizing facts, and presenting my own oral case. I don't always win, and sometimes the pre-law school me bubbles up and my underlying convictions show, but I am far better, I hope, at what I do because I stopped here along the way. The other thing we got from this place is an admiration, I think, even a reverence for the sturdy majesty of law itself. When I arrived on campus, most of my classmates couldn't put a finger on why they were attending law school. They said things like, I got in. I wanted to create options. Tough job market. You can't beat the credential. Rarely, if ever, at the start, did we hear much about law itself. But by the end of 3 years, most of us had come to understand that whatever motivated us to come here, law offered its own rewards. Law is the foundation for what President Roosevelt called freedom from fear and want, freedom from physical danger, and freedom from threats to one's property and one's dignity. Law is the one recourse the vulnerable through history have had against those who bullied them. Law today reflects the contributions and wisdom of countless people over time. In societies like ours, which are endowed with imperfect but durable legal systems, as the old saying goes, law is the wise restraint that makes men free. Of course, law's application and law's effects depend upon the determination and judgment of those of us privileged to be its caretakers. 2/3 of you will work in a law firm next year, 1/5 of you will take up clerkships, and 10% of you will work in government or public service. You will end up the Williams and Connolly associate, the lawyer in the city district attorney's office, the Texas public defender, the intellectual property lawyer, the rural family court judge, the legal blogger, the Tulane law professor, the local, state, or federal government official. Maybe you'll even end up writing fiction like Scott Turow. Regardless, it's in your hands to decide whether law will be enforced, whether law will be just, whether law will be used to slow or speed the spread of liberty and equality. It's on you, graduates, to decide whether law will do what it has done so often. In the words of the great Irish poet Seamus Heaney, make hope and history rhyme. As a non-practicing lawyer, I'm not going to stand up here and tell you how to use your law degree. I am no authority on these matters. But I can offer 4 simple tips that don't appear in the overachiever manual that you can pick up at the Harvard Coop. The first, never compare your insides to somebody else's outsides. At the start of law school, I didn't feel I belonged. Everyone else had their act together. It was completely clear. They seemed to know where to buy books, who to study with, what the teachers expected, what the cases stipulated. I marveled at how people so new to this world seemed to fit right in. My best friend in the world, John Prendergast, and I call our heads bat caves. And yes, that's from Batman, the bat cave where all the bats flutter about. And this is because we're in our heads so often that sometimes it's hard to concentrate with all the bats swarming around. In law school, I spent a lot of time with the bats. All of us did, as HLS is a bat-friendly place, a place where fears and insecurities run rampant. Of course, the fact is that when people feel unsafe, they are the least likely to talk openly about their bats. It was not until a couple years into law school, as friendships tightened and as all of us unwound, that we each learned that self-doubt was the rule and not the exception. We were all confused and groping. The only thing that distinguished us was how well we hid it. I've had the identical experience in government. Soon after candidate Obama won in November 2008, I was offered my dream job to serve President Barack Obama and to help him implement his vision for multilateral affairs, human rights, and the prevention of mass atrocity and genocide from the White House. As they say, oh my God. When I arrived in Washington with my campaign teammates, I was no newer to this experience than many of my peers, but everyone around me had purposeful, directed strides while I felt I was staggering around, bewildered by the bureaucracy. I hadn't been there long when I had my first meeting with then, now suddenly, President Obama in the Oval Office. Since my office is not that far away, I left myself 5 minutes to get there. The only trouble was I couldn't find the Oval. Turns out nobody passes out maps of the West Wing, so I had printed out a small map from the Washington Post website. But it wasn't drawn to scale, and I ended up on the third floor when the Oval, which is, you might imagine, quite hard to miss, was on the second floor. By the time I found my way, I was late to my first meeting with President Obama. 7 months pregnant at the time, I was also breathless and completely discombobulated. When I walked in, General Jones, our National Security Advisor, and his Deputy National Security Advisor were already seated. I sat down awkwardly, setting down the water bottle every pregnant woman keeps nearby, and trying to catch my breath before I had to start the briefing. Unfortunately, as soon as my battered Poland Springs bottle touched the surface of the centuries-old coffee table, a man I hadn't seen in fancy dress behind me reached over my shoulder and removed the unsanitary item from view of the 44th President of the United States. Now I'm in the equivalent of my 2L year in government, and every single one of my colleagues has told me a version of the story I just told you. When you get out into the real world, just like here, it's easy to believe that you and only you are the one who doesn't belong. When you get to Skadden, when you join the Department of Justice, when you take the Foreign Service exam, when you return to your country to start your own practice, when you walk into a philanthropist's office and make a pitch to raise money to launch your NGO, and you feel unsafe while everyone else seems to be brimming with confidence, remember, you see only their outsides. There could be a fleet of bats inside. Maybe that understanding will inspire not only a degree of calmness as you go forward, but also a compassion for others. Every one of you out there has a backstory, and probably a bat cave. Life is not about mastering uncertainty, it is about channeling it. Second tip is that selling out is really, really, really hard. And let me first define what I mean by selling out. By selling out, I do not mean working for a corporate law firm. By selling out, I do not mean making gobs of money. I just learned that you have paid $41,500 a year in tuition for the privilege of this remarkable education. That is an awful lot of money, and many of you probably have steep debt payments ahead of you. Though kudos to HLS for offering subsidies to those here in the summer and at other times who are exploring public interests. Kudos also, of course, to parents for supporting their kids where they were able. By selling out, though, I just mean doing something that requires you to check your heart at the door. I have classmates from HLS who are earning tons of money and love their lives. I have classmates from HLS who are earning tons of money and hate their lives because they don't actually want to be doing what they're doing. They read the class notes of the alumni magazine and sigh wistfully at the lives of others. No relative, friend, teacher, or graduation speaker can tell you what you should do. It's your compass, your values, your gut that will carry you. But if your compass, your values, and your gut don't like what you end up doing, I promise you that they will not keep quiet. First, they'll take a nap, waiting for you to pay back your loans, or hoping that the days will get more stimulating and the law more fulfilling. But then the compass, the values, the gut will start to speak. First they will gnaw, and then they will tug, and at some point they will start screaming, "No, this is the only life you have. You don't get a do-over." And then it will be time to make yourself vulnerable again, to take another plunge, even at the expense of releasing the bats. A job that doesn't feel right is no more likely to last than a marriage of the same description. It is hard to seek or experience inspiration when you're insulated in a life that isn't working for you. But even as you work your day job, if you start to feel that tug, try to expose yourself to places, issues, and people outside your comfort zone. People who defy gravity and make change later in life are seriously brave. Try, if you can, and you're in one of these phases, these moments, to remember that there are people out there who've stopped dreaming about a better world, have stopped believing that the blessed are also the just. Restore their faith that while they may feel forgotten, some kick-ass Harvard Law School graduate has their back. You've already done this while in law school. Each of you somehow did an average of 533 hours of pro bono service while here. How is that even possible structurally? And who are these mutant people, aliens, who did 2,500 hours of public service? I'm staggered by that. It's incredible. Nearly two-thirds of you did a summer of public interest. It's clear that you're searching, that you're seeking, that you're finding exposures. And no matter where you start out after you get out of this place, you can find your way back to loving what you do. It doesn't have to be the guy down the row from you who loves his job and respects himself. It can be you. But for that to happen, you will have to open your ears and try to hear your gut. Third tip, penultimate tip. In whatever you do, try to be fully present, truly present. As Satchel Paige put it, work like you don't need the money, love like you've never been hurt, dance like nobody's watching. You gotta be all in. This means leaving your technology behind occasionally and listening to a friend without half of your brain being occupied by the inner longing for the red light on your BlackBerry. I sat in on a close friend's Harvard Law School class a couple years ago. I slipped into the back row of Pound Hall Lecture Hall. I swear, just parenthetically, if I come to HLS as a senior citizen 40 years from now, I will still slink into the back row as the fear of getting called on will never leave me. Well, on this field trip to my friend's class, I got a glimpse of modern learning. Students had done away with spiral notebooks, and they had their laptops in front of them, typing away. But I was sitting in the back, and I looked forward, and almost every laptop I saw in the rows in front of me had split screens, notes from this particular law class, and then a range of parallel stimulants. One person was trolling through football statistics on ESPN, another was booking their flight home for Thanksgiving, and another was adding a friend on Facebook. What was so incredible about this is that when the students were called on, they managed not to betray, even for a second, that they were moonlighting. They were able to pull it off. You are remarkably good at multitasking. You have developed the modern muscle set. You are first-class grazers. And I say, I know of what I speak because I am a cardinal culprit. You have never seen an NSC official and new mother so dexterous in her ability simultaneously to BlackBerry and to breastfeed. Lovely image, right? But I promise you that over time, this actually just doesn't cut it. Something or someone will lose out. No more than a surgeon can operate while tweeting, can a public defender do his client justice or a corporate lawyer fend off motions with one ear in and one ear out. You actually have to reacquaint yourself with concentration, full-on concentration. We all do. We should all become, if we can, as Henry James prescribed, a person on whom nothing is lost. Fourth and finally, these are the good old days. I don't mean just your law school years or this gathering with family and friends. I mean every phase of your life stands a great chance later, retrospectively, of becoming a source of nostalgia and reminiscence, the good old days. Yet the same events, friendships, routines, challenges, that later become fond memories are too rarely savored in the moment. My husband Cass and I have learned some valuable lessons about this together. He's taught me this in a range of ways. As we leave the office at night, the fastest path to our car does not take us directly in front of the facade of the White House. But Cass insists we walk up the steps hand in hand, appreciative of the incredible opportunity this president has given us to serve our country. When we get home at night, we try to count our blessings. Silly as it seems, he makes us run through the 10 things we are most thankful for in every given day. And half of those things, as in people, are actually here with me today. Who or what is in your top 10? And how often do you take the time to reflect on that? Going forward, we're all vulnerable to accidents, personal tragedies, political and economic realities. But the one thing we control is how much of the journey we pause to appreciate. Albert Einstein once said, there are only two ways to live your life. One is as though nothing is a miracle. The other is as though everything is a miracle. Here, I'm with Einstein. Freeze this day in amber in your mind because I promise these are the good old days. Harvard Law School, class of 2010, thank you so much for allowing me to share your incredible, incredible achievement. Remember that this is the only life you have and you don't get a do-over. Argue well and fair. Never, ever forget the majesty of law and the privilege of having been anointed its guardian. Don't compare your insides to other people's outsides. Listen to your gut and know that a small contribution from you can make a giant difference to those who can never get here. Be present and savor every single one of these oh-so-precious good old days, starting with today. Best of luck, class of 2010. We need you. Thank you. Thank you.